We have organized tonight's event to explore one single question. Has political correctness on college campuses gone too far?
No!
As a group, the UMass College Republicans have always stood in support of the free exchange of ideas and viewpoints. As you watch tonight's panel, you may not agree with everything that is said, but we urge you to stand in support of free speech as well by carefully considering the arguments made tonight and by refraining from causing interruptions. Please help me in welcoming our first guest speaker, feminist author and Enterprise Institute scholar, Christina Hoff Sommers. Next, conservative comedian and host of the popular podcast, Louder with Crowder, Stephen Crowder. And finally, journalist and senior editor at Breitbart.com, Milo Yiannopoulos.
Let me give you an example right here, okay? Right now. This girl right here just yelled out that we were all racist. What? You just said you're not a girl? Should I use Z, the gender neutral? What's up? Yeah, what's up? You just yelled out that all of us were racist. And then you asked a question. And the question was?
Why are there only white people on your panel?
There you go. It sounded better when you were yelling it with a chorus of backdrops. Let me explain. Okay, can I answer your question? Do you want an answer? Would you like an answer? You don't know the answer, sweetheart. Let me answer it for you. Listen, you have, right here on this panel, you have a gay British Trump supporter, okay? You have a lifelong registered Democrat, open feminist, who's not a third wave feminist, and you have a French-Canadian Christian conservative. So you may ask, why is there only white people? Because the only diversity you don't care about is that of intellectual diversity.
Right!
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com for comprehensive show notes, book suggestions, or to just leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is July 19th. Was the show's title a little too provocative for your liking? I certainly understand. I have to warn you, this conversation that I have with Adam Alpow of the Voluntary Institute also gets off to a bit of a rocky start. Not between me and Adam, but between me and the social justice community. But I assure you, in this conversation and beyond this conversation, this was about a week ago, I'm really striving for understanding, and I do recognize more than once in this show that I have a lot of enemy imagery right now, but I've been investigating. I'm trying to get to the bottom of this, and you might feel like I'm diagnosing a whole group of people, but what do we mean by a whole group of people? Because this is one of the issues that I really want to address in this conversation and conversations that we have into the future about this problem that is really, really plaguing higher education right now. I think, as it currently stands, this label, social justice warrior, is being applied to too many people. If you were like me and you experience a fair amount of hostility towards the SJW crowd, and somebody tells you they're sympathetic to Black Lives Matter, or they've even attended a Black Lives Matter event, do we slap this label on them? I don't think so. If someone says they're a feminist, do we automatically slap that label on them? No. I think it's too simple and dismissive. I am going to present the idea today that the SJW is a special personality type. And there are cultural, environmental, and generational reasons why such people exist. And I'm not convinced at this point that there is a cure. But I think that as we approach this problem, we have to start not with hostility, but with some effort to understand what's going on here. And I think there's a very important container in which these people exist. There's an academic and a moral philosopher. His name is Jonathan Haidt. That's H-A-I-D-T. And I'm going to mention him a couple times in this conversation that you're about to hear. He was talking, I believe, with Sam Harris about this. And he attributed a lot of what we're seeing on college campuses today to significant changes in child rearing that took place throughout the 1980s and 1990s. And I started to reminisce about my childhood, and I think Haidt's attribution is actually quite valid here. He argues that people born before 1980, as I was, spent a lot of time without adult supervision, as I did. I remember being like 6 or 7 years old and saying to my mother, "Mom, I'm going for a bike ride, going on a little 6-year-old adventure in the woods." And my mom would say, "Okay, bye." Now, granted, I lived in a very safe area. I lived in, a very quiet residential development. But I remember, I think this was around 1984 or 1985. I was a little boy and there was a kidnapping. And I remember this panic took over our elementary school that we were all going to be kidnapped. We needed to look out for windowless vans. This was my introduction to the danger of the windowless van. You know, I mean, before that, a windowless van would go by, a white windowless van. And I would simply say to my naive little boy self, I wonder if there's ice cream in there. I can't say that throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s that the instances of kidnapping increased by complete strangers in windowless vans, but the media coverage of such events did. And we saw, by the time we got around many years later to JonBenet Ramsey, the little girl who disappeared, the media loves the never-ending story. Wolf Blitzer can't wait to get on the Situation Room every day at 3 o'clock and tell the world that he knows nothing new about this ongoing story. But by the time the millennials were born, kids spent virtually no time without close adult supervision. I mean, we see through the work of people like Lenore Skenazy, dubbed the world's worst mom, a badge that she wears proudly today, considering who stuck it on her. You know, people who are victims of this media culture where they instantly jump into hysteria about anything. So back in, 1986, when me and my friends were riding a bike in a sandpit through broken beer bottles and bullet shells, we were kind of left to our own devices when it came to a very, very important skill called conflict resolution. If you constantly have adults intervening in any minor conflict that happens between you and your peers, you don't really get a chance to develop these skills. My generation did. The previous generations, I'm assuming, were even better at it. Maybe not the baby boomers, because when they became adults and things went wrong, they said, "How about just do like a government program and then bill the kids?" But I grew up in an interesting time where the world still seemed fairly safe, and I was allowed to explore. You know, kids today don't have that anymore, and we see how it affects their behavior as they grow up. Most of this shit show involving the SJWs is happening on America's college campuses. College, is a time to explore. For me, it was a time to take chances, and I had this real drive to find novel activities, even if they posed significant risks. But this seeking of novel activity, this exploration, this is something that should be happening for these young people much earlier in life. And ideally, it should be encouraged by and under the loose supervision of loving adults like parents. We have, when nature starts to tell us that we're becoming adults, we have a biological drive to leave the nest and look for new things. And this should be happening, when we're 13 years old, 14 years old, 15 years old, but it isn't. That self-assertiveness, that natural self-assertiveness is beaten down. So until we get to college, we really don't get too much practice with it. So I think even though I'm going to be hostile today in this conversation, knowing more about the situation in which these people grew up helps us develop some empathy. And I think if we want to be solution-oriented, is this really, be honest with yourself, is this just a form of entertainment, these people? Or is this something you would like to see remedied? At times, I'm kind of on the fence about it. These people are massively entertaining. I can't wait to see what they do next. But their actions are detrimental to free speech, to whatever might be left when it comes to education on college campuses. This phenomenon is a kind of infection, not just plaguing the colleges, but plaguing these activist movements themselves. Black Lives Matter, feminism, other causes as well. I immediately find myself more hostile to these groups because of the actions of their most vocal and poorly behaved infiltrators. I don't understand why there isn't more dialogue about a conspiracy here. In the 1960s, when activist groups like this sprung up, the Nixon administration almost immediately infiltrated them with agent provocateurs. And I'm not saying that that's what's happening here, but there is a small group of infiltrators claiming to act on behalf of these projects and these pursuits, these causes. And it's destroying them and making us, you know, more hostile to them. We had this video that Kevin Geary posted in the School Sucks group last week, and boy, did this cause a problem. It was this eighth grade boy doing a kind of spoken word performance, poetry slam kind of thing. I'm going to play the video that was posted, and then we're going to talk about it a little bit.
Everyone should have the privileges that I have. In fact, they should be rights instead. Everyone's story should be written, so all they have to do is get it read. Enough said! No, not enough said! It is embarrassing that we still live in a world in which we judge another person's character by the size of their paycheck, the color of their skin, or the type of chromosomes they have. But most of all, it is embarrassing that we deny this, that we claim to live in an equal country in an equal world. I know it wasn't us eighth grade white boys who created this system, but we profit from it every day. We don't notice these privileges, though, because they don't come in the form of things we gain, but rather the lack of injustices that we endure. Dear white boys, I'm not sorry. I don't care if you think the feminists are taking over the world or the Black Lives Matter movement has gotten a little too strong, because that's bullshit. I get the change can be scary, but equality shouldn't be. Hey, white boys, it's time to act like a woman, to be strong and make a difference. It's time to let go of that fear. It's time to take that ladder and turn it into a bridge.
Now, I investigated a little bit more, and it turned out to be a little bit worse than just that.
How about an eighth grader stirring the pot? 14-year-old Royce Mann wrote and performed a poem he calls White Boy Privilege, and he starts by apologizing to everyone, basically, who's not white and male.
Dear women, I'm sorry. Dear black people, I'm sorry. Dear Asian Americans, dear Native Americans, dear immigrants who come here seeking a better life, I'm sorry. Dear everyone who isn't a middle or upper class white boy, I'm sorry. I have started life at the top of a ladder while you were born on the first rung. I say now that I would change places with you in an instant, but if given the opportunity, would I? Probably not, because to be honest, being privileged is awesome. I'm not saying that you and me on different rungs of the ladder is how I want it to stay. I'm not saying that any part of me has for a moment even liked it that way.
When did the idea come that you're going to tackle that terminology, white boy privilege? How long has this message been stirring?
I knew about white privilege and male privilege for most of my life, but I never realized how prevalent it was in our society until this year when I went to a new school called the Paideia School, and we take a class called Race, Class, and Gender, and that really made me a lot more aware of the privileges that I have that other people don't often have, many other people don't have.
So now we see there's really like this toxic collectivism that if you're part of this group, you owe apologies. This is what this boy is learning in school. But the publicity, and here's the silver lining, okay? The publicity that this little performance got. Remember when I was talking about, you know, Milo, the benefits of Milo Yiannopoulos and sunlight being the best disinfectant, him going into these colleges, stirring up all this shit. And then what's going on usually behind closed doors is brought to YouTube. It's brought to Facebook. It can be analyzed. And maybe that's the beginning of a solution to some of what's being pushed, either academically or culturally in higher education. But at the end of that interview, The boy says this.
I want to reach the people who are ready to have an open dialogue about this. There have been a lot of people who have commented on YouTube and just said insults without even mentioning the content of my poem or my beliefs.
Just see that terminology and they're out.
Yeah, but if they say, I disagree with you, here's why, and then explain it some, then I will be more than willing to discuss it with them. I've gotten some feedback that people have, I think, interpreted my poem in a bit of a wrong way and feel that I'm ashamed of my race and feel that I'm saying that white boys especially should be ashamed of their race and their gender. But in reality, I'm not ashamed at all, and nobody should be ashamed about their race because that's an uncontrollable thing. I was born this way. There's no reason to be ashamed of that.
Great. As far as I'm concerned, that's a step in the right direction. But in the School Sucks group, in the conversation that followed the posting of this video, the boy himself became a bit of a target. And I feel like I was careful. You know, my comment was, SJWs are stealing our children. Wasn't really an insult to the boy, because, you know, I've said for years that almost everybody who goes through the school process gets indoctrinated. And then I had this angry moment when I was reading through what was in this thread. I think this was Sunday night or Monday morning. And I said, this is what SJWs do. They've made us hostile to we're calling a 14-year-old boy a cuck. We should be ashamed of ourselves. And then I said, whoa, hold on, mister. That's no way to think. To say SJWs are so shitty that they're making us call a 14-year-old boy a cuck. Now, only one person used that cuck, and they didn't even actually call the boy a cuck. They said this is very cuck-like or something like that. Oh, and if you haven't heard cuck, go ahead and look up cuck. I can't veer off into that right now. I don't feel like it's constructive. So we can't abdicate responsibility and say this is what SJWs are doing to us. That's ridiculous. But this is what they are doing to the debate. People are jumping into super hostile positions with much more alacrity than I think they used to on a lot of these issues. So there's this outcome of the social justice personality type inside these movements that almost functions like the state. They say, oh, look at it. We got some problems to solve here. So we're going to do this, this, and this. Oh, shit, the problem's worse. Crime, terror, poverty, drugs, etc. Forest fires. The U.S. Forest Service caused a ton of problems with wildfires in California by stopping the small burns caused by lightning strikes. So when the forest floor can't burn off naturally, as it has throughout the history of forests, kindling builds up. So now when you get a forest fire, thanks to government intervention, it turns out to be a real blazer. So if the social justice warriors are having this government-like effect on the problems they aim to solve, will they see it? No. Because there is always the specter of the other. It's not the intervention that caused the problem. It's somebody else. It's the enemy. In politics, I'm not using that word anymore for the left. Lefties, Democrats, progressives, they make all these policies, right? They don't care about quality of government action. They only care about the quantity of it, it seems. So they make all these policies, one after another. They always have unintended consequences. And then they always blame Republicans. That's their thing. So in the social justice movement, it's going to be the same. It will never be their fault because there's always the enemy that they can pin it on. Now, most people, I think, in Black Lives Matter, most people who identify as feminists are those who are fighting against cafeterias and colleges serving sushi. Most of them are followers. It's true with any group. But this social justice personality type seems to be continually, across these activist causes, positioning itself in leadership roles and threatening to destroy whole movements. So let's dig into Black Lives Matter a little bit. Social justice warriors are always seeking divisiveness. They want to focus on, and I'm going to talk about why in the show, or why I think this is the case in the show. They always focus on what produces the most conflict. So there's this myth about Black Lives Matter that they don't care about black-on-black crime, even though it is so much more significant than police-on-black crime. Over 90% of black people who get murdered are murdered by other black people. But the critics of Black Lives Matter say they don't care about any of that. And I said, is that true? Are they really just ignoring that? Because that's like a big problem, you know? So this is what they say on their website, blacklivesmatter.com. The idea that black-on-black crime is not a significant political conversation among black people is patently false. In Chicago, long maligned for its high rates of intra-racial murder, members of the community created the violence interrupters to disrupt violent altercations before they escalate. However, those who insist on talking about black-on-black crime frequently fail to acknowledge that most crime is intra-racial. 93% of black murder victims are killed by other black people. 84% of white murder victims are killed by other white people. Now, that disparity of 9 points in percentages is something that the alt-right really likes to jump into, but we're not going to do that today. You know where you can go if you want that point of view. The continued focus on black and black crime is a diversionary tactic. I don't totally agree with that. Whose goal is to suggest that black people don't have the right to be outraged about police violence in vulnerable black communities because those communities have a crime problem. The Black Lives Matter movement acknowledges the crime problem, but it refuses to locate that crime as a potential problem of black pathology. So there, the split would be pretty wide between Black Lives Matter and somebody like Ben Shapiro, who attributes most of the violence in the black community to cultural problems. Like music and entertainment would be a big part of that in Ben Shapiro's mind. But it's moved beyond just Black Lives Matter to black versus white. And now there's people who are saying, why are black people not talking about how high black-on-black violence is? Because the most vocal participants in this conversation, the SJWs, have made the focal point the place where there is the most division and conflict. Because that's what they do. Because that's what they like. The result is that viable solutions to policing problems, which I think we agree in this audience anyway, do exist, are being drowned out. Solutions that even people like Radley Balco, who's an expert on criminal justice and a libertarian-leaning guy, says, yeah, this is good stuff. For example, Black Lives Matter has aligned itself organizationally with another cause called Campaign Zero, which is 10 I don't want to say demands, but enthusiastic suggestions for policing policy solutions. All 10 of these things really don't favor one race over another. And 9 of them, I really think that most people, regardless of race or even economic status, would benefit from. The exception is number 10, fair police union contracts. Whenever you see the words fair and union in the same sentence, look out. So let's just talk quickly about what these 10 things are. Number one, I'm going to shoot through most of them, but some of you might be unfamiliar with the term broken windows policing. Number one, end broken windows policing. The explanation is a decades-long focus on policing minor crimes and activities, a practice called broken windows policing, has led to the criminalization and over-policing of communities of color and excessive force in otherwise harmless situations. In 2014, police killed at least 287 people who were involved in minor offenses and harmless activities like sleeping in parks, possessing drugs, looking suspicious, or having a mental health crisis. These activities are often symptoms of underlying issues of drug addiction, homelessness, and mental illness, which should be treated by healthcare professionals and social workers rather than the police. I really, as somebody who spent a lot of time focusing on the zero tolerance problem in schools, I really can't argue with that. And let's shoot through some of these that are pretty self-explanatory. Community oversight, limiting the use of force, independently investigating and prosecuting, community representation, body cams and filming the police, better training, the end of for-profit policing. Let's dig into that one a little bit too. Police should be working to keep people safe, not contributing to a system that profits from stopping, searching, ticketing, arresting, and incarcerating people. Demilitarization of police, number 9, hooray. And number 10, fair police union contracts. Are those 10 things really that terrible? Now, I'm sure there's opportunities for lefties to pry into most of those 10 suggestions and exploit them for, you know, socialist economics or cultural Marxist ends. But on the surface, that's pretty good. Why haven't you heard about this? Why have you not, as somebody who's on Facebook probably every day, seeing more news about Black Lives Matter, why have you not heard about the solutions? It's not where the focus is. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. As always, I look forward to your feedback. I really think this is something we should be talking about in a constructive fashion. I do have to ask at this point, just before we get started, that you consider supporting the show. We have this new Patreon campaign that we've been doing now for a little over a week. You can find a link to it in the show notes. I'm pleased to announce that at the time of this recording, we are 9% of the way to our goal. Whoops, hold on. I did that wrong. I'm pleased to announce that at the time of this recording, we are 9% of the way to our goal.
All I do is win, win, yep. Win, no matter what.
Oh boy.
Got money on my mind, I can never get enough.
This is a celebration.
I step up in the building, everybody hands go.
Just 91% to go.
And they stay there, and they say yeah.
Oh, and I also wanted to say that Adam, towards the end of this conversation, throws us a nice compliment on the updated version of schoolsucksproject.com. So I want to thank Michael in Prague, who worked on this. That's not really how you say his name, but I'll explain that later. And our webmaster, Tony, he's been the webmaster for schoolsucksproject.com since the beginning of 2013. We have a working relationship that goes back even further than that. If you are looking for some guidance or some assistance with marketing or web development, his website is r3m.com. That's R3 Marketing. Tony is extremely knowledgeable. I learn something new every time I talk to him. And hot dog, you might even be hearing him on the podcast in the very near future. All right, everybody, let's get to today's show and see if we can solve some problems.
Hey! 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 All right, Brett, thanks for being on the show today.
My pleasure, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, Brett, you are from the School Sucks Project, schoolsucksproject.com, and at School Sucks Show on Twitter. I'm sure that many of my listeners are familiar with you, if for no other reason, because I have mentioned your show on peace propaganda many times as something that, you know, I really aspire to reaching this level of discourse that you seem to have mastered, this idea of, you know, you are the master of subtle answers, which I love.
You know, absolutely.
You if somebody asks you a question, you don't give a 2-3 word answer. You know, you like to dig into it and really understand not only the answer, but how it came to that. And that's great. I think that there's too little of that.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. You caught me at a time I find myself auditing a lot of my beliefs, kind of trying to spend more time in uncomfortable uncertainty. So I think we're going to have an interesting discussion today.
I agree, actually. What you're talking about is social justice warriors, and I want to get into that very soon.
Sure.
But first, I want, just for any of my listeners who somehow aren't familiar with your work, just give us a brief, what is the mission of the School Sucks Project?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we are primarily a podcast, but we also have a YouTube channel and an online community. And the mission of the School Sucks Project is really to help young people, high school and college age people, achieve greater individual liberty through self-knowledge, self-teaching, and self-mastery. And I think those three things really, really come in that order, like trying to understand who you are, what motivates you, what unique challenges you have related to, you know, your upbringing or your background or your, you know, emotional landscape. And once you get some clarity on that, and, you know, it's an ongoing process, it's very cyclical. I'm a work in progress, like I think most other people are. You have a good foundation to start teaching yourself in pursuit of some kind of vision for your life or even, you know, smaller, shorter term goals. And self-mastery is a little bit lofty, but I like the sound of it better than self-improvement. I feel like that's really overused. And we can certainly attain higher levels of self-understanding, aptitude, and achievement. So that is the outcome of, you know, knowing yourself and developing the ability to teach yourself.
Fantastic. And you've been doing this for years over at schoolsucksproject.com. If I could pinpoint, you know, just several things that led me to start my own podcast and led me to start what eventually would become the Voluntary Institute, definitely one among them would be your series on the Trivium.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, if anybody listening hasn't gone through that and they're interested in sort of the foundations of the learning process, what your project on the Trivium, I think, is an excellent place to start. And it should be no surprise now, after you gave that explanation to my listeners, why I wanted you on the show. Because, of course, your work is very educational. And we just started here, the Voluntary Institute, voluntaryinstitute.org, which is a educational nonprofit dedicated to mastering the non-aggression principle.
Awesome.
Yeah. And actually, we're really pleased to announce, we just announced on the last episode that Tom Woods is now a member of the Voluntary Institute Board of Directors. So, you know, I really think we're going to be able to build something great here. And I'm glad that you are on the show to, you know, help further that in any way that you can. So I want to get into the idea of social justice warriors. But first, I want to lead into it with, you know, maybe how people get to ideology. And I know you've had things to say about this in the past. The idea that, you know, how much of a person's ideology is learned versus how much of it is just ex post justification for existing biases. You're familiar with this concept, I assume.
Yeah. This is certainly not a new phenomenon. I was actually talking about scientific racism, of all things, with somebody, with my friend Wes Bertrand last night. We were recording a show. And this topic came up because it's a hot topic right now. You know, even 100 years ago, you could see in these academic communities, in these intellectual communities, ideologies in search of science, right? In search of scientific justification. So people would believe a thing, probably because it was, you know, a predominant belief in their community or in their family or in their sphere of influence, or sphere, not their sphere of influence, but the inside the sphere that was influencing them. You know, if they want to hold on to that, most of us know, especially people who are fairly self-aware, that you have to seek justifications for those beliefs. So, yeah, I think you nailed it. We have a schooling system in this country that doesn't really encourage us, and this is both K through 12 schooling and quote unquote higher education. It doesn't really encourage us to seek out and develop our own beliefs system, you know, to really assert ourselves in that way intellectually and defend ourselves in that way intellectually. So a lot of people wind up just absorbing what's around them or what makes sense at a given time. I've done this several times in my life. You know, when I graduated from college and even when I started teaching, I was very liberal because that was the environment that I was in at the time. There was no debate happening about that ideology, and I just absorbed it and accepted it.
Right. Yeah, that's dead on, I think. And I think that a lot of people fool themselves into thinking, oh, well, that's just how other people work.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's almost unavoidable that, you know, even people who really make it a mission of theirs to try to seek out these internal biases and then of course go back and examine whether or not, you know, the belief held because of the biases is factually based or relevant to today's world, you know, even they probably have dozens of unexamined pre-existing biases that have led them to believe things. So the idea that there are so many people out there who just go throughout their life assuming that everything that they believe about the world is the result of rational analysis is, patently false, of course.
Yeah, that auditing process is really important. And John Taylor Gatto had a great statement about how he argues, you know, with himself. He finds himself confronted with an ideology or maybe something that he's even somewhat impelled to believe just at first examination, and then goes through a process of deliberation with that thing, a very active process, a very mindful process. And in my own experience, I don't remember having a very enthusiastic attitude towards education. So if somebody had easy answers, then great. You know, that's another thing that I don't have to worry about. And actually, in one of my recent episodes of School Sucks podcast, you know, we were talking about the challenge of bringing the ideas to voluntarism to other people who just say, look, man, I'm pretty sure all this stuff is figured out. You know, I go and I vote, I throw a quarter in the toll booth, I send a check or I get a check from the IRS once a year. And that's all I have time for in that relationship with the powers that be. So, you know, thanks for taking time to look into things or whatever, but I'm all set. You know, I've got other concerns. So, yeah. I think that one of the hidden lessons of school, in addition to obedience and conformity, is a kind of intellectual or philosophical apathy. And I say that because that was very much me. As soon as somebody seemed confident in their convictions about an ideology, which was basically European socialism or social democracy when I was about 20 years old, it was hook, line, and sinker for me. I said, this guy knows what he's talking about. You know, he knows all these facts about the Civil War. He knows where so-and-so died and where so-and-so is buried and where this general went to the bathroom at Appomattox Courthouse. Like, how could he be wrong about political philosophy? So, yeah, I just took it because I had that intellectual apathy.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I think that leads well into our discussion about social justice warriors then.
Sure, yeah.
Because I think that on the extreme of that, it seems counterintuitive to call social justice warriors apathetic. But I think in a way they are. In a way they are at least apathetic to their own internal biases, which is they came, you know, usually into a college environment. As you said, they are surrounded by very intelligent people. You know, I'm certainly not here going to say that college professors are not intelligent, but they have biases and they are definitely pushing ideas either consciously or subconsciously. And because these college professors are so intelligent, yet in many cases very misguided when it comes to social philosophy, I think they sort of ensnare a lot of people into thinking, oh, well, like you said, if they know all this stuff about X, Y, and Z, then they must know all about politics. They're so smart. And so then social justice warriors are typically people who have unexamined biases, who have, you know, probably good intentions, at least as far as their virtue signaling goes. But at the same time, they go off on this extreme of, you know, advocacy while having all of these unexamined biases. So, you know, what's your take on social justice warriors? Do you think that they are, you know, entirely misguided? Do you think that there's any reaching across the aisle, so to speak, in engaging with them? You know, what is your stance on social justice warriors? Should they just be avoided?
Well, we can avoid them, and it's a self-perpetuating problem for that reason that you described, because there's this insularity in belief and a kind of apathy that leads to an unwillingness to be challenged, which is very dangerous. And it's becoming, really powerful inside higher education institutions, where a small group of people are actually affecting policy and pedagogy. And that's really troubling. I mean, I'm not too worried about it, because I think like the institution of higher education maybe has another decade before like even its most ardent defenders can't justify its existence anymore. But, you know, on this whole topic, when you say these people have good intentions, I'm going to say, even though we're going to be taking some language shortcuts here, I think, and I do want to stress the importance of, you know, treating people like individuals and evaluating an individual based on his or her merits, kind of in accordance with voluntarist principles. But, you know, to solve a problem or to address a problem, you know, you have to recognize some patterns, and there are some here. And I think the umbrella of social justice warrior is too broad, because underneath it you have all the Black Lives Matter people, all the feminists. And I think that within all these different interest groups and activist groups, you do have people with good intentions. But I think this term, social justice warrior, is actually a specific type of character that has infiltrated all of these organizations and is destroying them. You know, I think that Black Lives Matter was started with a purpose. I think feminism exists with a purpose. I think people who are out talking about, you know, rights for gay people, there's noble purpose there. But I think what we're seeing is a particular narcissistic personality type that is infiltrating and infecting and destroying from within all of these activist pursuits. And I think, you know, most of the people who fit into this category are millennials, who were growing up, you know, right as the age of political correctness was beginning. I was in high school and in college in the 90s, and this was something that was talked about but not enforced. People younger than me, like especially people who were born in the late 90s and beyond, so people who are in high school and college today, I think these people were in this perfect storm of this acceptance culture, you know, the culture of 11th place ribbons where like you're special even if you don't achieve. So that addresses one problem of school. Like you shouldn't rely on school or authorities to make you feel good about yourself. But on the other hand, you should have an achievement-oriented mindset and just this idea of equality that everybody is equal no matter what they do and everybody is special and everybody's opinion is equal, which is one of the most dangerous ideas in world history. That school culture combined with Web 2.0, like the ability to participate through sites like Facebook or Twitter or blogs, kind of created this perfect storm of narcissism. You know, I mean, yeah. I would have said that, yeah, it's great to be inclusive and it's great that everybody can participate in the web. But it seems like in this millennial generation, it's produced a problem that we haven't really figured out how to solve yet. I try to stay out of most online debate because I see this as kind of like the training wheels phase of that form of communication. And it's not, I'm not saying that, you know, in a derisive way for anybody who does it. I think it's fine. It's just not for me. And I think it's a medium of communication that will evolve, but people are basically still learning how to use this stuff, right? So I think that there is a unique problem there that millennials face, that they were raised with this idea that their opinion matters regardless of merit or regardless of research. And they have a forum to express that. In fact, they never grew up in a world where that forum didn't exist. You know, since they've been, you know, 10 years old, Web 2.0 has existed. And that's one foundational problem. I think there's interesting theories like Paul Joseph Watson from InfoWars, who said this is the daycare generation grown up. Which is basically a jab at them, you know, saying they're behaving like people in a daycare. But the idea is that in a daycare, because there's so many children and so few adults, in order to get attention, you have to make the most noise. You have to be the worst behaving person there. And then you could, you know, mix into that, like, you know, what Stefan Molyneux is pushing is that this is basically the neutering of the patriarchy. Mm. So a lot of these softer attitudes are the result of the absence of strong men. And I wouldn't want to hang the whole issue on that idea. I think there is some anecdotal evidence of that for sure. I mean, when I was growing up in the 80s, the fathers on sitcoms were typically stronger, more respectable characters. I can't believe I'm going to use Bill Cosby as an example, but as Cliff Huxtable on The Cosby Show, you know, he parented well, he was respectful to his wife, he had fun with his kids, he right. created a predictable environment, but an environment where they had freedom to make mistakes. Stephen Keaton on Family Ties, he is at odds with his son, Alex P. Keaton, who's very conservative, well, he's kind of like an old hippie. But they have like an understanding and respect that even though there's comic moments, it really comes through in the show that the relationships in that family are healthy, even though the siblings fight and the parents kind of mediate that and understand that. Mr. Seaver from what's the Kirk Cameron show? Growing Pains.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you have these kinds of respectable male figures. And, you know, by the time the mid to late 90s rolled around, they're replaced by Peter Griffin.
Right.
You know, and that model has been used in live action television since then as well. So I think there's some truth to that, but that's not really like a powerful all explaining type argument. What the, you know, Steph says about, and those are my words, not his, the neutering of the patriarchy. But there are an absence of strong male figures. And we have seen how that can lead to more childish behavior into adulthood.
Right. And that's, of course, something that I think even a leftist feminist who is consistent would be receptive to that argument, because, of course, much of the feminist argument for many decades has hinged on the idea that there aren't good female role models in many mediums. So the idea that there is at least a diminished quality of male role models, you know, in the last couple decades should ring true, I would think, to a wide swath of the population.
Yeah, absolutely. So those are, you know, you have Watson's theories, you have Steph's theories, you have this problem of everybody is special no matter what they do or don't do. And you also have the millennials kind of being born into PC culture and never really knowing anything else, where they don't learn about, you know, even though it's very questionable how these values were embraced by America or American leaders right from the very beginning, but they don't learn about the Declaration of Independence or the ideals of freedom. They are being raised believing that the highest values in society are equality, diversity, and inclusion. And if you prioritize anything over that, like individual liberty or property rights or self-ownership, you're a racist or a sexist or a bigot, you know?
Mm-hmm. And of course, it's not even necessarily a prioritization above that. I think the best expression of, you know, the rights of everyone is property rights. The best expression of equality is equal justice under the law and your ability to maintain that which you have worked for.
Yeah, that's a big one. The perversion of the idea of equality. I mean, if you like talking about all people being equal, and I think this will come up later in the conversation, is an extraordinarily silly idea.
Of course.
You know, but all people getting equal treatment under the law is a foundational idea for a stable society if you have to have one of these governments, you know. I mean, that's really important. And, you know, we see in the last week Edward Snowden's great tweet, if you expose classified information to help the people, you go to jail. But if you do it for personal gain, you can be president. Right. So we definitely see there is an equal treatment under the law, and that creates a great amount of resentment and instability in society. So that's the equality that's important.
Right. And I think the more that people get exposed to that, the more of a marketing victory that is for the liberty community.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back to something that you said a few minutes ago about one of the most dangerous ideas in history, which is that all opinions are equal, because I think that is really foundational to that special kind of pernicious social justice warrior. If we're trying to narrow down the problem element, because I agree, it's not everyone. If we're trying to narrow down the problem element, I really do think that a lot of it comes down to this idea that all opinions are equal, and that, you know, this is where the idea of safe spaces and microaggressions and invalidating experiences comes from. And a lot of the ideas that really get twisted and blown out of proportion in the social justice warrior movement. I was hoping maybe you could elaborate on what it is, this idea that all opinions are equal, and why you think it's so dangerous.
Sure. Well, we could do a thought experiment or kind of a visualization where you have an astrophysicist standing at a debate lectern next to a man who's wearing a tinfoil hat, and he's there to argue that the Earth is hollow and aliens live inside, and this is something to be very concerned about, or maybe even we live inside and we don't know it, and the things that we think are stars are actually cities on the other side of the hollow Earth we're in. And wouldn't it be silly to think that these are equal opinions, the astrophysicist versus tinfoil hat man? But this actually appeared, I think, in 2011 in this context that we're talking about, the idea of the progressive stack. Have you ever heard that term?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not familiar.
This is something that was introduced at Occupy Wall Street once that was infiltrated by these social justice characters. And in New York City, they announced to one of the groups that, look, we're going to create a stack of everybody who wants to speak, everybody who wants to be heard, but then we're going to give preferential treatment to groups that have been historically marginalized. So essentially, yes. If you're a white man, you should relegate yourself to this lower position. You shouldn't feel like you have the same right to be heard as everybody else.
Right. I remember that. I was actually there for that. I was there for the first few weeks of Occupy Wall Street.
Oh, dang.
Obviously not as a social justice warrior, but
right.
As a lot of the media didn't, wasn't very keen on mentioning how many Ron Paul supporters were at Occupy Wall Street, how many End the Fed people or how many other conservatives or libertarians were there. It was really portrayed as like 100% progressive liberals, but there were a lot of non-progressive liberals. So, but I do definitely remember a turning point, partly fed by the media blitz around it, saying that it was a progressive thing. Then all the progressives came out of the woodwork,
right,
and sort of pushed out the other elements of it. So yeah, I actually do remember when that happened.
Right, because you would have had an opportunity for, and people tried to build this alliance between, you know, libertarians who were tired of crony capitalism or tired of the Federal Reserve, and people who were more traditionally aligned with not just the left, but the actual liberal part of the left that right. is against crony capitalism and probably even the Federal Reserve as well. But this progressive stack, once that idea catches on, that kind of breaks that alliance, right? And it creates tension where there doesn't need to be. So it's inserting identity politics into a place where it doesn't belong, you know?
Right.
And that was, I think that was very toxic to the overall success of the Occupy movement. It became a progressive nightmare, basically, after that. So even if you were bringing the most valuable ideas or suggestions to that, you're being told in this case that your opinion is certainly no more valuable than anyone who just wants to speak because they feel like they're part of a marginalized group, or even if they legitimately are part of a marginalized group and they've experienced being marginalized because of their identity. Don't think that just because you know more or you have more to offer that your opinion is going to be considered important, right?
Right.
Everybody's opinion is equal. And now I'm even kind of backing away from that, because what this is saying is that some opinions are less valuable. So really what it is it's the breaking of a meritocracy. It's saying that merit doesn't matter. So the all opinions are equal is one step away from, you know, running a kind of discourse based on merit. This is even a step further away from, like, you can win a debate with the most information, the best logic, and the best rhetorical skills. Now, none of that even matters anymore. It's all about identity.
Yeah.
So we've moved beyond all opinions are equal. That's we've moved to an even worse place, even though I think I said that was one of the most dangerous opinions in the world.
Yeah, I think you're generally right there. But I think the social justice warrior, because, you know, I think we can't have a constructive criticism of them without a more complete understanding of their position, of course. So I think what they would reply is that there is an experiential learning of being part of a marginalized community, which then gives someone in that community the ability to speak. I don't know what the best word would be, but with more competency, perhaps, on an issue. And so in terms of a meritocracy, that gives them that merit to speak. Now, of course, this is not a belief that I hold, but I do think it's important to, you know, give full airing to what it is that we're criticizing.
There is a justification there. It's not complete insanity.
Yeah. Right.
And I think that, you know, I best understood this conversation. I was really, really frustrated about this topic maybe 10 months ago when I was really immersing myself into what was happening, places like Mizzou and Dartmouth and Yale. And I had a conversation with the historian Thaddeus Russell. It was called, I think, Putting College Race Tensions in Context. It might be episode 385 of School Sucks Podcast. And he provided, like, a lot of really, really valuable context specifically on the issue of race that helped me understand that feeling of marginalization much better. So there's this problem of this word racism and everything being called systemic racism or structural racism. So as a result of that, young people who are Black or other minorities are feeling like there's little distinction between, you know, Mizzou in 2015 and Alabama in the 1960s. And that's very, very inaccurate. There is a long history of race consciousness and race exploitation in this country. And a testing ground and a laboratory for a lot of that has been in academia, starting all the way. I mean, this starts in the 1700s, but it really, really catches fire in the early 20th century with, you know, scientific racism. So even though this goes back to the days of Thomas Jefferson and it has other sad and embarrassing moments, like there was a doctor during the period right before the Civil War, an antebellum doctor named Samuel Cartwright, who was tasked with explaining why slaves want to flee captivity. And he said it was because of a disorder called drapetomania that makes them disobedient and disrespectful to the will of their master. So you see, they have a mental condition, and this is basically why they need to be slaves. But scientific racism, even though there might have always been racial difficulties or racial divisions throughout history, or at least an awareness and a kind of apprehension about different races throughout history. Scientific racism is the first time that you really have a systematic body of thought on, you know, race as a way to put people into categories. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, mainstream academia is writing about this until the 1940s. And why the sudden switch? Well, you know, when you're trying to make, you know, race and categorizing and ranking races and ethnicities into a science, and it wasn't so, the ethnicities didn't get ranked so much because what they would do when a new ethnicity would show up in America, they'd just be like, okay, you're black. You know, and people would be like, we're actually Irish from Ireland. Yeah, you're black. For now, you're black. We'll see how you do. The same thing happened with Italians. The same thing happened with Jews. And this is all in Thaddeus Russell's book, A Renegade History of the United States. But in the 1940s, this idea breaks apart because America is fighting another country that's making the application of scientific racism look like a very, very evil thing. You know, mm-hmm. in Germany. So there's this retrenchment in the intellectual community and in academia to get away from this idea. And, you know, at this point, all of the progressives who were fine with scientific racism, who were fine with eugenics, you know, they now start saying, like, no, let's use our powers to uplift these people and assimilate them into our society. Right.
Right.
This is an idea that is, you know, white supremacist. It's a kind of cultural imperialism, and it's switching from this acknowledgement or this belief in racial inferiority to cultural inferiority, right? So in higher ed, this catches on, and it takes this really paternalistic form that minorities, especially black people, should be this kind of diorama on display for the benefits and the cultural development and cultural enhancement of white students. So right. as a result, you know, and people are so, you know, ham-fisted about how this happens in academia in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, right up to today, that, you know, as a result, even though I don't want to speak for another group of people, I would have to think that that patronizing environment would lead to a lot of feelings of isolation. And that seems to be what a lot of people are, a lot of minorities are expressing in these protests. And, you know, they're being imported to these places and almost set up to fail for like this liberal guilt or leftist guilt, I guess, would be a better word for it.
Right. So, because, I mean, of course, it's very illiberal.
Yes. Yeah. And they're essentially the victims in this ongoing larger progressive project to basically, you know, treat society like it's their own fantasy baseball team. You know, we want these people to come in from here, and we want these people to have less of a voice and these people to have more of a voice, and just kind of structuring society from, you know, the ivory towers of academia without really living in it or experiencing it.
Right.
So it's very gross. And there is, you know, a real cost, I think, in the experience of a lot of minority groups as a result of that.
Right. And it's so important to know the history of it. As you said, the history of it through progressivism, this lineage of scientific racism. And then even before that, the idea, the colonialist idea of the white man's burden, you know, bringing culture to the savages and all of this idea that, you know, it's our job to lift people up. But in order to do that job more effectively, we first have to delineate where everybody fits in this into neat little categories so that we can figure out, you know, as you say, scientifically, how to, quote, you know, best help them, because God knows they can't help themselves in this framework of understanding the world.
Yeah. Yeah. The worst enemy of most minority groups is the progressives who profess to be helping them all throughout the 20th century.
Right.
You know.
So I want to switch gears a little bit, still talking about social justice warriors, and talk a little bit about strategy. Mm-hmm. What do you think of, and I'm just going to go from 0 to 100 here. What do you think of Milo Yiannopoulos and his mission seemingly to basically just stir the pot as much as possible, to basically just throw everything, you know, sort of in the social justice warriors' face, get them as riled up as possible? What do you think of that strategy?
Milo has tactics that I like, and he certainly has tactics I don't like. At times, he's way too incendiary where he doesn't need to be. I understand that that's his style, and I think the overall the drive behind what he's doing is good because, as I said in a recent show with Thaddeus, sunlight is the best disinfectant. To know what is going on inside these closed communities in academia where these ideas are being propagated and reinforced, you know, really without any debate. Him going to these places and shining a light on this is extremely valuable, even if his tactics are not, you know, the way I would do it. I would be there trying to do workshops on, you know, identifying people that you can reach out to and then how to reach out to them. I think that there's a lot of people that you're not going to be able to reach out to. I don't think that means we need to, you know, develop a bunch of enemy imagery, even though I have to admit that I do have some. But I think that, you know, the most important step towards the solution is kind of understanding, in addition to that basic context that I gave at the beginning of the discussion about, you know, they're millennials raised in this Web 2.0, everything is acceptable, non-meritocracy type environment. There's other factors as well that contribute to this problem.
Absolutely. I would agree. You know, I think I struggle with it because on one hand, like you said, you know, he is very incendiary, and it's not something that certainly I would want my name attached to.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you can't argue with results.
No, you can't.
Every time that you see these, you know, the most crazed element of social justice warriors, you know, screaming at him, you know, screaming the worst things imaginable, you know, calling a gay man who openly professes love for black men, mm-hmm. you know, calling him a racist, calling him a faggot, you know, things that would be unthinkable for a conservative or a libertarian to say, suddenly become fair game when the enemy is despicable enough to
right.
them. I think really, as you said, shines a light on how toxic the ideology has become of social justice warriors. So as I said, it's tough to argue with results. That said, I would certainly prefer, as you said, more of a workshopping strategy. I want to transition then and bring that into the idea of marketing the Liberty community. Because as a capitalist, it seems obvious to me that firms have already solved the problem of getting people to buy into a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And they just call it marketing. And it reaches beyond Coke versus Pepsi. It's not about facts and numbers when we're talking about marketing. It's about identity and lifestyle signaling. I think Apple is a great example of a brand reaching beyond what would otherwise be a very niche crowd of dedicated followers because it has successfully positioned itself as the hip technology company. Do you think the Liberty community has a marketing problem or do you think, as so many other libertarians do you think it's just about honing a factual analysis of the world?
As far as the marketing problem is concerned, libertarianism is actually somewhat susceptible to one of the problems that we see in this social justice world. Right now, and really in the last 2 years, we see people gaining tremendous amounts of power from aggrievement. There are people out there who are seeking someone or something to justify their failure, to confirm their fears, to confirm their suspicion, and to say, there's your enemy and here are the rocks, right? But I think that, you know, we actually have, as people who are talking about the problems with state power and, you know, the other kinds of domination systems that hinder us early in life, I think we actually have a legitimate argument there. Because all of these things, you know, when you say it's not your fault or you should be suspicious or this is your enemy, all of these things were done to us before we had a chance in life to say no. You know, our parenting, our schooling, our churching, and of course, then there's the state that's imposed on everybody. You know, we never got a say in any of that. So while I certainly don't want to position myself or describe myself as aggrieved, I think, you know, in helping people realize that, you know, there are some things that are suboptimal in your life that are not your fault, but they are at this point your responsibility to deal with. And the problem as far as making a connection with these aggrievement empires or this aggrievement industry, you know, whether it's racism, patriarchy, white privilege, xenophobia, or, you know, other things like society's demand for the perfect female body or whatever people see as the enemy, it doesn't seem like those people who are pushing those ideas are interested in personal responsibility. So it seems to me like, at least right now, at least with what I know right now, and I would be happy to hear, you know, other people's thoughts on this, it seems like that bridge is going to be hard to build. And I think that there's other factors that contribute to that as well. I see this social justice personality type as something very pernicious. And I would be worried from where I stand right now about trying to connect to these people and bring them in to the philosophy of liberty. I think a lot of them would come just because it offers the same kind of aggrievement and targets as mm-hmm. as some of these other movements. But what I see is a small but increasingly powerful group that uses race, that uses gender, that uses sexual orientation or cultural inequality as battering rams to plow their way through institutions in an attempt to meet what I guess would be a need for personal efficacy. And then the institutions are caving because these people have successfully associated themselves with those causes. And then the causes become the shield, you know? So they use it as a battering ram to get through the institution or to upset the institution. And then they hold it as a shield to say, oh, you want to criticize me? Well, you're a racist, you know? Right. And the damage that they're inflicting is really, really significant. I mean, they are producing hostility towards the groups they claim to represent. So I don't know if we want to try and reach out to these people or recruit these people. And again, I think it's really important to stress, this is not an umbrella that includes everybody associated with Black Lives Matter, everyone who's associated with feminism or any other type of legitimate justice movement. It is a special subset of characters that have infected all of these movements. So I think the outreach needs to be to the rational people in Black Lives Matter, and they exist, the rational people in feminism, and they exist, to say, you know, I don't exactly know how to package this message yet, but you have a bad element to root out. I mean, these are people who are actually, I think, making a lot of the public more openly racist and more openly misogynistic because of the tactics that they've used, right? So it's that Al Sharpton effect. Right.
Right,
and
right.
If you ever see like an Al Sharpton press conference after there's been some white on black crime, you can hear people in the background, black people going, get away from us. You know, you don't speak from us. And I think speak for us. And I think you need to have more people in these groups that at their root, you know, these movements have, I think, legitimate grievances. They need to be more assertive in rooting out the bad element inside, especially in higher education, because what they're doing is we're seeing rape being trivialized because of what they've done. We're seeing racism being trivialized because of what they've done. We've seen the idea of liberalism destroyed and replaced with illiberals and regressives, you know, because they've now added Muslim without any criticism of the tenets of Islam. That has been added as the seventh aggrieved group or the seventh marginalized group. So you can't say anything bad about Islam or, you know, you're an intolerant racist.
Despite the contradiction there of the, you know, huge issues of Islam against race, against religion, against gender.
Women. Yeah, exactly. So so they've gone from progressive to regressive in that respect, because they're now protecting illiberal attitudes. They've distorted the language. They've squashed debates. They're changing the curriculum. So I see them more as, I don't want to compare anyone to bugs, but I'm not saying these people are termites, but I see it more as like a termite problem. And there are all these groups, Black Lives Matter, the feminists, groups that we should be able to build some bridges of connection and empathy with. Those, as soon as these people see these bridges, they're throwing grenades at them, the social justice warriors. Mm-hmm. And like I said, the special dangerous personality type that exists is something that really, really has to be identified and rooted out. You know, there's a saying that's often associated with protests, no justice, no peace. I'm sure you've heard that, right?
Of course.
Okay. So, and this has been one of the chants at a lot of these movements. And yeah, I think that there's legitimacy to that idea. But there's no way to satisfy these people. They don't want peace. So they will make sure there is never justice. If one, you know, legitimate gripe is solved, if there's a resolution to one of these problems, they're just going to find another one. It doesn't matter how ridiculous the cause becomes. They don't want peace. They don't want connection, not from what I've seen. So they will make sure there is never justice. That I honestly believe that.
Yeah. And of course, there's huge institutional frameworks behind there not being justice that they are blind to. Much of it revolving around the state. Mm-hmm. And it's so unfortunate that the perceived solution to so many alleged social justice issues seems to be crawling back to the nanny state, which is unapologetically the perpetuator of many of these issues. I mean, slavery was not a private institution. It was endorsed and perpetuated and enforced by the state. Yet this is completely swept under the rug.
Right.
And of course, there's just a litany of these issues. Talk about war. Talk about the racism inherent, you know, as recently as the Korean and Vietnam War, putting all black platoons together, throwing them on the front line and saying, whoops, you know, but this doesn't ever get talked about. So it's crazy and it's backwards to me, the not only how social justice warriors have reached these conclusions, but also the perceived solutions to these issues is really unfortunate. And I hope that the Liberty community becomes better at not necessarily attracting social justice warriors, but attracting people who might otherwise fall into just sort of a de facto regressivism, into a sort of just a de facto, well, everybody around me seems to think this is a good idea, so I guess that's what I have to believe now, too.
Right. Well, you know, I really want to stress the idea that what's the saying? I don't know if Joe Rogan came up with it. You know, we have a mental health problem disguised as a gun problem. You know, or something yeah. like that. I think this is really the case of a mental health problem disguised as an aggrievement problem. Again, I really want to stress this. These causes that these people infiltrate are legitimate. I really don't like how their tactics wind up demonizing whole movements, really starting, at least in my awareness of this whole phenomenon, with Occupy Wall Street. I don't mind that something is a left-wing cause. In this world, when I see something like that, I say, hey, I'm just glad people are awake, you know, right. And if they're awake and they're motivated, maybe we can talk to them. I said about Occupy Wall Street, they kept going around saying they were the 99%. You know, I saw them as more like the 0.1%. You know, the 1% of people who actually realize how serious the problem is, and the 10th of that percent that's actually willing to get off their ass and do something about it. So, yeah. I saw that as a potentially very powerful movement that was, again, destroyed from the inside. So I think that being said, and that being, you know, reiterated now for like the fourth time, finding the rational actors inside not just these movements, but also in academia, because the institutions and the faculty are culpable in this too, because they're being paralyzed by fear. You know, these people are basically using terrorist tactics, combing that quite terrorist tactics. But as far as using fear as a weapon, there was a liberal professor who wrote an article a couple years ago saying, like, I'm almost getting afraid to teach some of these kids because they're combing through my syllabus, you know, looking for racist or sexist material to call me the carpet on.
Wow.
There's another academic. He's a moral psychologist. His name is Jonathan Haidt, and he's been on Tom Wood's show a few times, and he had a really interesting conversation with Sam Harris on Sam's Waking Up podcast. And he talked about, you know, somebody shutting his whole class down because he showed a video that had a discussion about homosexuality that the student interpreted as intolerant. So he was basically terrorized by one of these movements for a whole semester, you know? Wow. And so think about how that small group leverages their power in a way that's detrimental to every student in that class. What does it mean for that professor who, like most professors, probably want to do a good job? I've had a ton of enemy imagery towards academics generally, often for the purpose of humor. But I think there's a lot of people there who do want to do a good job, especially this Jonathan Haidt, and he gets shut down. It has to devote all of this time and energy and resources to fighting attacks instead of teaching students who want to learn.
Right.
Right. So this is not a college-wide, university system-wide problem, but the power and the leverage that this small group has is significant, and it's something that needs to be given serious attention, I believe.
I agree.
And, you know, what does that mean? If academia was going to continue to exist. What does that mean for the education of those students? You know, how do we make progress as individuals? We usually have to experience some kind of discomfort, right? How do we grow as intellectuals? Usually through, I don't know, the experience of some amount of discord and debate, at least some interaction with people who don't agree with us. And all of this is being stamped out. You
right.
know?
The only kind of diversity not valued is intellectual diversity.
As Steven Crowder said, yes, that was a fantastic quote.
Yeah, it was. Well, Brett, I really appreciate you being on the show today. I thought this was just a great conversation. I want to get into it more. I hope you can, you know, fit the show into your schedule again in the future. But, you know, I really feel like we gave people a lot to chew on today.
Yeah, hit me up whenever, Adam. That was a very enjoyable conversation.
Great. Yeah, I agree. You're obviously welcome back on the show anytime. And I want to make sure that my listeners know where to find you, which is at schoolsucksproject.com.
Yep.
And I also want to just mention that is a slick looking website. I really like it. It's very difficult in the Liberty community to separate the wheat from the chaff as far as, you know, is this just a WordPress blog, you know? But no, you obviously, I mean, if you didn't spend hours yourself, obviously you have some professional help going on there. It's a great website. It's a great resource.
I have a great friend. His name is Tony. He's been a very important advisor to School Sucks for over 3 years. And for people in my audience who are interested, I'm going to put a link to his website in my show notes when I repost this. And I also want to say a big ups to this gentleman in Prague, whose name I think is Michal. But he insisted that we call him Michael because he thought it would be a waste of time us trying to pronounce his name correctly. So he said, you can just call me Michael. He did some work on the site behind the scenes. And Tony is my webmaster and web developer. And a lot of like the you know, the design and color schemes, I do all that stuff. So, yeah, it was a group project. And I definitely appreciate the compliment.
Yeah, well, it came together fantastically. So obviously, everybody needs to check it out. Everybody needs to get on the mailing list because it's, you know, it's great stuff that comes out. Subscribe to School Sucks Project. Get in the AV Club to help support your show because what you're doing over there is incredibly valuable. One of the best podcasts in Liberty scene, bar none. And of course, your Twitter at School Sucks Show, at School Sucks Show.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much. And can you just give all of your details for my audience when I repost this?
Absolutely. You can find Peace Propaganda. The best way to find it is to go to voluntaryinstitute.org. That is the nonprofit educational organization that produces this show. And there you will find links to all of the shows as well as ways that you can subscribe via iTunes or RSS or anything like that. And you can, of course, follow my show at Peace Podcast on Twitter.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Adam. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, Brett.
A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. A handle hit out in the dark. A hand sent the spark. Two eyes took the aim behind a man's brain. But he can't be blamed. He's only a pawn in that game. The South politician preaches to the poor white man. You got more than the blacks, don't complain. You're better than them, you've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, so it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in that game. The deputy sheriffs, the soldiers, the governors get paid. And the marshals and cops get the same. But the poor white man's used in the hands of them all like a tool. He's taught in his school from the start by the rule that the laws are with him. to protect his white skin, to keep up his hate, so he never thinks straight about the shape that he's in. So it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in that game. From the poverty shacks, he looks from the cracks to the tracks, and the hoofbeats pound in his brain, and he's taught how to walk in a pack, shoot in the back with his fist in a clinch, to hang and to lynch, to hide neath a hood, to kill with no pain, like a dog on a chain. He ain't got no name, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in their game. Today Medgar Evers was buried from the bullet he caught. They lowered him down as a king, but when the shadowy sun sets on the one that fired the gun, you'll see by his grave, on the stone that remains, carved next to his name, his epitaph plain, only a pawn in that game.